Fred Katz from The Athletic joins the show to help us recap the Sixers win over the Heat last night, preview Philadelphia's first round series against New York, as well as all the other Eastern Conference playoff matchups. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to another edition of No Cap Room on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me today is not Dan Devine, but we've got another man around the New York Knicks ecosystem. It is one Fred Katz, aka the Knicks beat reporter for The Athletic, also the host of the podcast Tampering on The Athletic NBA Show, as well as his own Knicks specific pod that I have been on, Katz and Shoot. What's up, man? How are you?
I'm great. I'm a little disappointed. I have the same reaction every day that you just did, where I wake up and I'm like, damn, I'm still not Dan Devine. That sucks.
Yeah.
It would be so much better if I were. But I just have to be me. But it's fine. Today, I get to hang out with you, so I'm feeling good.
There you go. Yeah, we had specific requests from super producer John Gennaro to get one Fred Katz on the show. So
it's because he doesn't know me that well yet. Once he does...
He's about
it's
to
over
the next hour, and our listeners will as well. We're going to bounce through the Eastern Conference playoffs and definitely spend a bit of time on Philadelphia versus New York, as that is the purview directly for our guest here today, who spent many a late night hour like Tom Thibodeau crunching the film, watching Joel Embiid's touches against New York's center platoon. But yeah, let's get into the game last night that set up this 2-7 matchup where Philadelphia will probably come up I-95 on Friday before Saturday's 6 p.m. Eastern tip-off at Madison Square Garden. The Sixers vanquished Miami 105-104. They got past the Jimmy Butler skeleton in their closet with a huge heroic effort from Nick Batum. There's some injury stuff with Jimmy Butler that we'll get to after this. But I think just from macro, let's just start from a big picture standpoint. I took the train down yesterday, got into Philly at 3:13 p.m. to 30th Street Station, took the Uber over. And from like the walk through the South Philly Sports Complex into the stadium and out to the sideline, there was definitely this air around this game of just, let's avoid Boston, which I think added an extra element to like the, is this an elimination game? Like, what is this? I actually texted a bunch of analytics guys around the league, and I said, has anyone quantified what's at stake in this game compared to a standard playoff game? Because it's different. It's obviously different, but it's not an elimination game either, this 7-8 matchup. So after talking to certain people, I have dubbed it game 6.5. It's not game 7. It's something in that space. And the idea this year in this particular game that, you know, with all the matchup jockeying stuff with the Cleveland Cavaliers that happened while Fred and I were watching the Knicks do the exact opposite against the Chicago Bulls in their Sunday matinee regular season finale, the talk that Darvin Ham dubbed coming out of an insane asylum of the Lakers potentially ducking Denver. This was kind of the opposite. This was like, and what I think the competitive spirit of sports should be in terms of the matchup jockeying and what this play-in tournament really is about. It's like, man, we've worked all year. Only two games separated the 7 seed from the 3 seed. And a win right now puts us in a much easier path to not have to go, especially for Philly's sake, to not have to go through this team that has stood in the way of us getting to the second round of the playoffs year after year after year. That was very apparent to me in this game, as opposed to, I don't feel like that was like in the air. I mean, I wasn't in the building, but that didn't feel like it was an undercurrent coursing through the Lakers-Pelicans game on Tuesday night.
They should want to duck Boston. They absolutely should. I don't even want to say duck Boston, because you're not that's not ducking is, you know, what Cleveland did, how they rested a bunch of guys in the last day of the season in order to duck Philadelphia. That was that was ducking. But they should want to not have to play Boston. They should want to win in that round and not have to face Boston until potentially the conference finals. Boston has been the best team in the East all season, by far. They won the conference by, what, 14 games? They had an 11.7 net rating, outscored opponents by 11.7 points per 100 possessions during the regular season. That's like 4.5 points per 100 better than anybody else. For like 4.5 points, like for reference, the 49-win Pelicans won games by an average of about 4.5 points per 100 possessions. Like that's the difference of a 49-win team between first and second place there. Boston dominated the league the whole way. Their top six is completely and utterly dominant. And if Boston doesn't win the East, barring injury, it's because something totally and completely unexpected, probably something wrong on the Celtics end, just went completely amok. And they shouldn't want to play Boston. I don't think it's an insult to the Knicks to not want to play Boston, considering the way that the Celtics have rolled over the rest of the East throughout this entire season. I mean, they haven't played a game that has had any kind of meaning for like literally a month. They've just been sitting there mathematically clinched at number one for like a month. I wouldn't want to play them either. That team is talented as hell. They're well coached, really good. And I would, you know, everything about them, they've got five out, they can shoot, they drive, they kick. I mean, defensively, they're versatile as hell. Drew Holiday is like Olympian an accessory Drew Holiday, for them.
Put respect on his name.
Drew Holiday is like an accessory for them. They're like, you watch them and you're like, you know what? Like, you watch their offense and it's like, you know, okay, you got Tatum, you got Jaylen Brown, who's been especially great for the last like 2 months. You got Derek White, who's handling the ball more. Porzingis is stretching the floor. He's picking and popping. And it's like, oh, right. Every once in a while, they'll throw Drew Holiday in action. You'll be like, oh, right. Drew Holiday is here, just like guarding centers. They'll literally put Drew Holiday on centers just so they can switch pick and rolls because Drew Holiday is so unbelievably versatile. I just, that team is scary. That team is awesome. I would not want to play the Celtics either. And you should want to win just to want to get into the playoffs. Where sure. is the world's competitive spirit? Maybe I've been covering Tom Thibodeau for so long, for sure. Too long.
For sure.
But where is the world's competitive spirit? Like,
Tyrese Maxey said that post game. He said, if you just want to clinch your spot, you want to earn it. Now we get 2 days rest. We don't have to have another game. That was the thing. Like, shout out Eric Kareen from The Athletic, your company. He's on the Heat beat right now for this play. And we were both saying, we hope the team were cut. Like, I went to Philly. And I've gone on Friday if they had won. I didn't want to go back to Philly. He didn't want to go back to Miami. Like, you just want to take care of your business. You want to eat the meal in front of you and nothing more.
Totally. And like, you don't know what's going to happen down the road. Like, you want to get in. First of all, the talk of the Lakers losing. Yeah, it shows how Lakers centric everyone's mentality is, that the conversation was, should the Lakers lose in the first round?
Everyone, I think that was Harrison Fagan and a couple of other
right.
Los Angeles. Twitter,
I mean, there were. It was the discourse. It was enough of the discourse that Darvin Ham was there answering questions about it.
It's true,
and it shows a very Lakers-centric mentality that the dialogue that we saw was consistently, should the Lakers lose so they don't have to face Denver, and nobody said should New Orleans lose so they don't have to face Denver. It's true. They're playing the same damn game. They're the ones who don't have Anthony Davis and LeBron James. They're the ones who didn't make the conference finals last year. Maybe they should lose so they don't have to.
They did duck
Denver.
let's bring this back to Philly though, because I think sitting there, especially in the second quarter now, because the Heat started in a man, it was late in the first, and they switched it to 2-3. They brought out like a 1-2-2. Three-quarter court trap that fell back into the 2-3. It was kind of like matchup zone-y too, where sometimes Caleb Martin would be up and like kind of up in Tyrese Maxey's space, and they'd kind of shift those two guards, they'd flip them. I mean, it was pretty impressive to see how much ground the weak side guard of that zone was covering to shadow Embiid. There was three people around him on all of his touches. He was moving the ball slowly, processing speeds were going very, very, very out of whack from him to Tobias Harris to Buddy Hield and Tyrese just playing hot potato around the perimeter. And like, I remember, I've definitely said this on the show before, I remember being in Denver before game six of Nuggets Suns last year and in the media room watching game six of Philly Boston when the Sixers had a chance to close out that series. And the difference of how much of a pulling teeth situation it was for Philly to get Joel Embiid the ball, let alone anything else, just to put the ball in the MVP's hands compared to how Nikola Jokic can just touch it all over the place, whether it's ripping a rebound and dribbling up the floor, or just he can come out and touch it pretty much anywhere he wants, back to the basket, facing up, whatever. It was given really scary deja vu of that precisely. And my Philly fan group chat of the friends from high school were definitely taking shots at Nurse in it, being like, this is why we fired Doc. Like, why can't you have this team positioned to beat the zone? And it was funny. The post-game, Nick said something to the effect of like, well, we didn't do what I said we should do pregame. So that was a little bit of a deflection there. But I think the fact that, and the stat line isn't gaudy, but the fact that Embiid finished that fourth quarter the way he did, the couple trail threes, just absolutely firing a rocket, I remember, to Nick Batum on the left wing, really making plays at the nail. That type of grimy performance to me is something that Sixers fans in my life and people in the organization were yearning for to see in those elimination games, not even elimination games, the games that they could have won to advance, the advancement games against Boston last year and in years prior too. You know, Ben Simmons and that missed dunk opportunity with Matisse Thybulle against the Hawks, against Fred Katz's Hawks, definitely lingers large, but like Embiid has his own moments waiting for that series as well. And to me, this whole thing of will they get out of the second round? Is this the year? It's even like a bigger monkey on their back to get out of the second round, I think, to win, to even like think about winning the conference finals. Like it's a kind of a bizarre, like the Sixers definitely look at themselves as a title contender, but also at first only care about getting out of the second round at the same time. That, all that, I thought, you know, I want to give Nick Batum his flowers too. And the moment where the bricking for chicken happened with just less than seven to go in the third quarter and Caleb Martin misses twice and Mike Breen is going nuts on the broadcast. And that really like enlivened that fan base that I grew up being a part of. Shout out to my younger brother who bought tickets to the exact section that we grew up going to games with my dad. It was like, I kind of watched Embiid shed a lot of the playoff baggage. And I wonder if that is put to the side, or is that just like been put on the carousel and it's coming back around and it will be back when they arrive in New York?
I don't know. I mean, I think the Knicks are going to defend him very differently than Miami did. The first thing that comes to mind is the Knicks just don't run. Like Miami threw a lot of zone at him, which I thought was really interesting because Miami actually didn't run quite as much zone during the regular season as they did last year. And I thought it was really interesting they came out running that very effective defensive style, especially in the first half, where it really troubled Embiid. And we should say, like, he doesn't look like 100% of himself right now.
Not at all.
He's not moving like anything close to the most dominant version of himself right now. And I agree with you. He took over in that fourth quarter. A lot of times what happens when a guy is so great, he sees a defensive style and eventually he just is like, okay, now I've seen it. Now I know the reads. Now I know mm-hmm. where to go. He started getting out a little bit in transition more. He hit those trailer threes. He started to distribute more. And you mentioned him kind of carving up Miami in the fourth quarter from the nail. And that's something that I think is going to be very important. Because while the Knicks don't play zone, and I actually have a story that I have filed on this at this time, but has not come out yet. While the Knicks don't play zone, they do absolutely include certain zone concepts into their defense. And one of them is basically just letting OG Anunoby improv away from the ball. And Anunoby is so damn good. Whenever there's some sort of action happening at the nail, maybe somebody's coming around a screen from a pick and roll, maybe a big like Embiid is posting up or facing up, whatever it is, Anunoby is so damn good at whenever you least expect it, just coming over from the other side of the court and getting a hand on the ball or disrupting a driving path or preventing a pass that could have otherwise happened from happening, causing some sort of discomfort, force somebody to pick up their dribble, whatever else. And what the Knicks tried to do, so Embiid only played the Knicks one time this year. He missed the other three times those two teams played. But the Knicks, basically the most, I'd say 95% of the Knicks' strategy against Joel Embiid was just make sure he catches the ball away from the paint and then let Isaiah Hartenstein work on him. If Embiid was out of the paint, the Knicks weren't double teaming. They weren't really shocking him with double teams. They weren't really trying super creative stuff. They said, you know what? Isaiah Hartenstein is really good defensively. This is how you know Tibbs thinks Isaiah Hartenstein is really good defensively. It's not because of what he says. It's because when Hartenstein is out on an island against Joel Embiid, the reigning MVP, he doesn't send help. And he lets Hartenstein work on Embiid. When Embiid catches it deep, that's when the Knicks are sending doubles. What that tells you is the Knicks are just like, we feel good when he can just work against one guy. We feel good enough to where we're not going to give everybody else cutting lanes. We're not going to give everybody else standstill threes. And what Embiid does in those positions when he catches the ball at the nail, I think is going to be a massive decider in this series. If he just roasts them from that position, which he has done to every single team in the league at some point or another, and he is capable for doing for not just a series, but for an entire playoff run. If he just roasts them from there, then Philly has a really damn good chance of winning the series. And if the Knicks are able to say, you know what? Hartenstein is guarding him in those, is getting him away from the paint, and then is guarding him in those positions well enough to where we don't feel the need to send over aggressive help, then I think the Knicks are in pretty good shape, because all of a sudden that means they are doing a pretty good job against the arguable best scorer in the world.
Let's just keep this kind of in the Philly Knicks ballpark since we naturally got there. I think from my vantage point, one of the more interesting subplots to New York's postseason and their season at large has been this ongoing talk about how to fill the minutes when Jalen Brunson is on the bench, how to uplift New York's offense in the sparse couple of, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes maybe when it comes postseason time, when he won't be out there. He could be playing all 48 minutes. That being said, when you go through round after round in the postseason, which New York does hope to do, they're the 2 seed, 50 wins. They have a very, very, very tough matchup here. This is not your typical 7 seed. And if Joel Embiid does find ways to work his way back through the conditioning stuff, which that's that point about his shape, Fred, just like from an overall physicality standpoint, that was the lead of my story last night, because it was so telling to me. Every single foul shot, he was all the way on the other side of the court, hands on his knees, adjusting the sleeves on his legs and the brace and hunched over and catching his breath. Did not look like someone who was out there having a blast, you know? So the 2 days rest here before that game, I don't think they'll be valuable compared to having to play Friday night. Absolutely. That will be a huge benefit for his overall trajectory back to all-star / maybe even MVP levels. But that's going to be something that is going to play a factor in this series for sure. On the flip side, I think with New York, you have to at least, it's not going to be congruent with the Tom Thibodeau way, but I think you have to be looking for opportunities to at least spell Brunson if you're trying to get past Philly and then get past whoever wins Milwaukee, Indiana, and then try to get past Boston. Like, if he's playing 48 minutes of playoff basketball, which we all know is a different level of intensity, different game from an officiating paradigm that we've kind of been playing in the last two or so months anyway, but it's, I mean, last night you could just feel it in the building, there's a much greater level of physicality and stuff that guys are getting away with. It'll be important to have that Bojan Bogdanović, Deuce McBride, whatever the combination is, if Alec Burks is able to come back from the dead and do something, like, it's, to me, I think a real little thing and something that I was surprised how, frankly, bad Bojan Bogdanović was in the first month or so of his arrival in New York. And I was really taken in that Chicago game, and then going back and looking at the numbers, how well he finished everything. So this is your beat. Am I overvaluing this, or am I hitting the nail on the head here, or somewhere in between?
I will say, first, I will just quick comment on Bogdanović. I think a big thing for him was just getting used to coming off the bench. He hadn't come off the bench in so long, and I think the rhythm kind of threw him for a loop. He's hinted at that to a degree, and that was kind of my intuition to begin with, because if there's one thing that Duke can do, it's score. He can shoot the three. He can shoot the mid-range. He can catch and shoot, and he just – it's not like, oh, Bogdanović is scoring, but he's giving it all back on the other end. It was just like he wasn't in rhythm, and now he looks like he's in a much better rhythm. He's been good for the last month, whatever it's been, 3 weeks, something like that. I would expect the version of him that we've seen the last 3 weeks or so to continue. As for Brunson off the floor being a concern, I will not even answer, Jake, with a yes or no. I'm just going to read you this. When Jalen Brunson, so since the Knicks traded for OG Anunoby, and the reason why that is a significant marker is because, not because of Anunoby coming in, but because of who they gave up. They gave up RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickly. Quickly was the sixth man of the year runner-up last year, the guy who ran the reserve unit when Brunson was off the court. And Barrett was a starter, but the Knicks consistently staggered him, so he played with the bench unit. And those are two legitimate scorers, two sources of offense who could get them buckets in transition, out of the half court, when Brunson was out of the game. And when they made that trade, they lost those two sources of offense. It's not a knock on the trade. It's just like you got to give up something to get something. That's what they gave up. So since that trade, the Knicks played 50 games. Jalen Brunson on the court, the Knicks score 122.9 points per 100 possessions. That's ridiculous. For reference, 122.9 points per 100 possessions, if it belonged to a team over the course of a season, would be the greatest offense of all time. Not just number one in the league. Number one all time. When Brunson, so 122.9, remember that number. When Jalen Brunson is off the court, the Knicks score 102.6 points per 100. 20.3 points per 100 fewer. That's not good. That is a very large disparity. The Knicks have not been able to score without Brunson for the most part since they made the trade for Anunoby. And part of that is because they've had injuries, some of which have gotten better now. And Tibbs, especially of late, has played around with possible lineup combinations behind Brunson. And one thing that I'm very curious to see, and my intuition is that this is what he will do into the series, is the last, I don't know, week and a half of the regular season, 2 weeks, he started using this lineup that started to do kind of better than any other non-Brunson lineup has done in the last 3.5 months. And what he did was he basically went, okay, Brunson is off, but you're going to go Bogdanović and four defenders slash creators. And it's basically all of your good two-way guys around Bogdanović. And one of the things that I think will be really interesting is that lineup, which includes Dante DiVincenzo, who's a starter, which includes Isaiah Hartenstein, who's a starter, and it includes Deuce McBride. For what it's worth, I think we're going to see about as much Alec Burks in this series as we'll see Allen Houston. They're probably going to play a similar amount of minutes.
He's faded into obscurity here.
Yes. I mean, he has really struggled since the trade. He's just not, it's not even that he's not hitting shots. It's just the ball hits his hands and doesn't touch anybody else's, and their offense just he is part of the reason why the non-Brunson minutes have been such a struggle kind of once you remove Burks from the non-Brunson minutes, all of a sudden they start to look a little bit better.
Yeah.
But you have McBride out there who has been a revelation, who's just been so one of the best stories on this team this year, no question, with his comeuppance. But one of the things I think will be really interesting to see how they balance is what are they going to do with the centers? Because the thing with Hartenstein, I know you love his game.
I do.
He, part of the reason why that lineup works is because he's such an important connector for them offensively. And on top of that, he's one of their best defenders. And you look at the advanced metrics on Hartenstein, by the way, and it's like second in the league in defensive estimated plus minus. Like, dude had a really good, really, really good defensive season during the regular season and did a great job on Embiid the one time he guarded him. And he's become this very important outlet for when Jalen Brunson gets trapped, which you know Philly is going to do at least a decent amount throughout this series. Where
it was part of their plan against Butler last night.
Yeah. Yeah, where Brunson will get off the ball really quickly to Hartenstein. Hartenstein will make a play kind of in that half court Draymond Green 4-on-3 because he's a skilled big and a good passer, and they've really been very successful with his passing. That's not something that Mitchell Robinson does. That's not Mitchell Robinson's game. You're not going to give him the ball and have him make a play.
Not Precious Achiuwa's game either.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Precious is really going to play in this series either, as long as they remain, you know, constituted as they are. So I know the Knicks would love to keep Hartenstein with Brunson because of the way that he helps them when Brunson gets trapped. I also know the Knicks would love to have Hartenstein play with the bench because of the way his playmaking and that kind of stuff kind of props them up when they don't have Brunson out there, along with DiVincenzo and the rest of the crew that I mentioned. I think it's going to be very interesting to follow to see when they use Hartenstein, who had been on a minutes restriction for a long time to close the regular season. And I don't anticipate him playing like few minutes or anything like that during the series. And it's possible they're just going to say, screw it and eliminate it. I don't know where they stand on that yet, but I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they use Hartenstein, how they use Mitchell Robinson, who was having a fantastic year on the offensive boards and defensively before he had ankle surgery in December. It's going to be, and has not looked the same since he come back, admittedly not in midseason shape. We talk about Embiid not looking like himself, Mitchell Robinson, lower starting point. But
they can just play each other into conditioning. That'll be a great little kumbaya moment.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm just very curious to see how the Knicks rotate their centers.
Me too.
How much they want to use Hartenstein with the bench to prop up the non-Brunson minutes, how much they want to use him with Brunson to prop up the Brunson minutes, how much they want to match him with Embiid, if they want to match him with Embiid. Does Mitchell Robinson, after a week off leading into the playoffs, start to look like the old version of himself defensively, and now all of a sudden you've got 48 minutes, like the best 48 minutes, consistently the best 48 minutes of center defense of any team in the league? You know, that's a plausibility if Robinson starts to look like he did, you know, he does it his normal version of himself. So that's going to be a really interesting piece to follow.
We need to get to an ad break, but before we do that, is there any other Knicks Philly thoughts that you have that you want to clear out and let you Jalen Brunson isolate at the top of the key and take some pivots and some head fakes and some all the herky jerky tricks he's got in his bag? What do you got for our listeners here before we pivot and go to the other series around the conference?
It's going to be really interesting to see these two starting lineups up against each other. When Philly's got like the four guys, whether it's D'Anthony Melton or Oubre as that fifth guy, I think they were plus 22 per 100 possessions with those four guys on the floor. It's what Harris, Maxey, Batum, and Embiid. Mm-hmm. Plus 22 per 100 possessions with those guys on the court. And the Knicks starters, when they're all together, have really crushed teams too. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens when those two units face off at the starts of first quarter, starts of third quarters, and maybe the close of games. Hey, it's going to be super interesting. It's going to be pivotal.
Yeah, D'Anthony Melton's health will be critical, I think. not critical, but it'll be an important subplot to Philly's postseason. There was someone with the team I was speaking to pregame last night who was saying, you know, we need him. We're hoping he's back, which is like a little bit optimistic as opposed to the just kind of doomsday. We don't know when he's playing stuff that's kind of come out of there. So that's not me reporting that he's coming back. I'm hopeful to see it too, because you want to see these teams at full strength. And I am very excited for more Nick Batum, being that I filed a underrated playoff X Factor story to Yahoo Sports before the game tipped off yesterday. Nick Batum was on the list, baby. He was on the list before he blitzed Miami's defense with 6 threes. And I mean, the putback out of nowhere on Tyrese Maxey's transition layup was incredible. The block on Tyler Herro at the end. He's been a favorite of mine since the Portland days. It's great to see the entire world recognizing the brilliance of Nick Batum as he's maybe playing in his last season ever, as his wife told some media outlet back in the fall when he was still with the Clippers. So shout out Nick Batum, the crown jewel of the James Harden trade. And we will talk about Knicks Bulls and other East first round playoff matchups when we get out of this ad break. Welcome back to No Cap Room. Fred Katz is here in the seat of Dan Devine. Not as handsome, not as bearded, but equally clever and charming and comedic and all the above. The Miami Heat will be playing the Chicago Bulls on Friday in Miami after Chicago dispatched Atlanta and their porous defense. Shout out Kobe White, man. Like, we've given him a ton of praise on this show in the past, and he's, I think, personally rounded into a legitimate all-star candidate for seasons moving forward, and showed it off last night. So that matchup, I think, will be very intriguing Friday, depending on, I mean, Jimmy Butler's been ruled out. So what Heat culture can they whip up to combat that loss will be interesting. I mean, last night with him sidelines pretty much at this, I mean, he wasn't on the floor at the end of the game. The entire offense is running through Tyler Herro, Bam Adebayo, pick and rolls. And, you know, Duncan Robinson didn't play. So that adds another element to their offense with his DHO stuff and movement shooting, and Terry Rozier has been out. So they have things to potentially fall back on with his absence. But I want to shift this quickly to the Hawks, being that I think that's part of the interesting element of all the playoffs. It's what's the postmortem of when these teams' seasons come to an end. And the defense has been something that I don't know what the answer is right now. I think there's probably the bigger question that everyone is going to ask, and the Hawks are going to ask themselves, of the Trae Young, DeJounte Murray pairing did not work. Which one are we going to have to move here this summer? And to me, just based off of a developing understanding of the offseason marketplace, I think you're going to have to, if you're Atlanta, consider just moving the one that brings you back the greatest return, regardless of what direction you want to go through. I think that could ultimately end up being the most pragmatic path forward from just an asset collection team building standpoint. And my guess right now would be that player is Trae, which would be a much harder decision for the Atlanta Hawks ownership to come to after pretty widely known affinities for him from that group, and him being Trae Young. So I don't know, Fred. How big of a, you know, you cover the Knicks, where the Donovan Mitchells and the Joel Embiids and the Giannis Antetokounmpos are always looming on the periphery of that team's overall situation. Where would you think Trae Young can factor into the potential star realignment that is always up for the taking every summer?
You mean with the Knicks specifically, or
just in general? Comparing him to those other types of names that fans like to Photoshop into New jerseys.
I think somebody would give up a nice package for Trae Young. And I don't know if Trey is overrated or underrated. I just know he's not properly rated by anyone. I think people look at him as either the guy is on, you know, this next level unbelievable engine, or you can't win with him. And it's probably more likely somewhere in between. I think somebody will do it. The question is, will the Hawks have enough leverage to get everything back that they hope to get? You know, they were the Hawks. One thing with the Hawks is whenever they are shopping someone, everyone knows they're shopping that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lose all their leverage because everyone knows they're shopping that guy. We'll call it the John Collins conundrum. All right.
Call it the DeAndre Hunter conundrum. Call it the Clint Capella conundrum. Like, it's kind of a bit of a pattern.
The DeJounte Murray conundrum, who they were, you know, calling around and making trades for and making trade negotiations for and seeing what they could get. And they just didn't get enough for him. It didn't work with DeJounte Murray. And one of the reasons why it didn't work with DeJounte Murray, honestly, is a reason that I don't think many people anticipated when they made the trade. Even if you hated the trade, Murray was one of the best defensive guards in the league in San Antonio. Great deflection guy, good in the ball, feisty as hell. And defensively, those two are a nightmare together. And Murray had, I think, the worst defensive season of his career this year. When Young and Murray were on the court together, 123 points per 100 possessions allowed. That's a disaster. Offensively, the offense was okay when they were both on the court. But part of the reason the offense was just okay, and by the way, that team is constructed for when you have those two guys, like the offense has to be elite. It has to destroy other teams. Part of the reason why it was just okay and reached that level is because the offensive rebounding when they were on the court was really good. They actually shot pretty terribly, which doesn't have to do very much with DeJounte Murray and Trae Young. I think there are a good amount of teams that will probably look at Trae and be like, we need a really specific fit. This is a really specific fit. For example, the Knicks are always star hunting, but you have Jalen Brunson. You're not going to go add Trae Young. He's a small guard who you need good defenders around. But if you are the, and to be clear, I'm not reporting this with any amount of sources. I'm just looking at rosters, knowing playing styles and all that. If you're the Orlando Magic and you're like, what we need is a point guard. What we need is somebody to run the offense. We have the defensive infrastructure, the defensive culture, and the defensive talent and the defensive schematics in order to withstand a guy who is going to get picked on, because you can play him next to Jalen Suggs, because you can play him with Jonathan Isaac, because you have two massive forwards in Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner. Maybe that's the type of team that's like, yeah, we'll give up some stuff and bring in an all-star point guard that is still really young and fits the timeline that we're going for right now. So I do think somebody would make some kind of move. Murray, I'm more skeptical about, just because, I don't know, man. I think the league noticed what a weird season he had and how much his defense fell off. I think that's part of why he wasn't traded during the season.
Part of your John Collins conundrum is when the team that is trying to trade you is putting your name on a billboard of big blinking lights. It makes everyone look a little bit more closer at you, and you can't really just skate by on any reputation from years past.
Yeah, it's very true. So I agree. I think they'd get more. I think they would get more for Trey. I think they have to do something with it, because it's not that it's not working. It's that it's clear that it is not going to work with those two guys together. Defensively, they're just a nightmare defensively. I watch them and I'm like, how is this? I don't care what the numbers are. How is this not the worst defensive team in the league? Probably the worst defensive team in the league of any team that was trying to win.
Yes.
This season, you know, they gave up 150 points to the Pacers 3 out of the 4 times they played them. It's just like, if you play a team that plays fast, they're just not going to get back.
Yeah.
They're just not going to get back.
Part of that, I think, has been Clint Capella took a step back this season, both like literally and figuratively. It just guarding in space out in the perimeter, not the same type of player. But to in the interest of time and moving this forward, I think the Lakers are definitely a team that will call and have called. That's probably one. I mean, all the San Antonio talk, it will be very interesting to see if the Spurs in general just go look to spend at that position at all after Trey Jones had a pretty successful season once he moved into the starting lineup and was given the keys there full time. The Orlando thing is interesting as we can try to use this to shift into a Magic Cavs kind of preview, being that I think from what I believe, and dating back to the trade deadline, the Magic were linked to Jrue Holiday and Chris Paul, and they were a big Tyus Jones rumor destination. I don't necessarily, though, think that the Magic are looking to find a nominal point guard to round out this team. The names that I've heard are, you know, Klay Thompson, everyone's heard, and Malik Monk is like a combo guardy guy who's just as much of a shooter as he is an on-ball creator, because everything I've heard out of Orlando is that they really like having Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner be these supersized on-ball creators. And it's a really interesting matchup to me between Cleveland and Orlando that no one will watch outside of NBA TV. And this is quite an easy matchup for the editors of national media outlets to completely ignore, being the markets that are in play here. But the fact that these are two, I mean, Cleveland, I guess in theory, is a little bit ahead in the timeline cycle of Orlando, being that they sent out everything they could to go trade for Donovan Mitchell, and they have multiple all-stars on the team, and this is their second straight postseason appearance in this 4-5 matchup when Orlando is finally broken free after tearing things back down in 2021 and trading Nikola Vucevic to get the pick that became Franz Wagner and being bad enough to get the pick that became Paolo Banchero. But two massive teams with a lot of length that have built their identities around that, that are just going to be ramming into each other for however many games. And they split the regular season series 2-2. There's been a ton of injury stuff for Cleveland that has never really given them a full iteration of what their team is from start to finish this year. But there's a lot on the line for the Cavs, man. Like, to basically tank for this matchup, when also we've been hearing talk of JB Bickerstaff's job being on the line since November, it's that you can't lose this series if you're Cleveland after what happened last year. And just because it's their first time in the playoffs, I don't necessarily think Orlando is going to be an easy victory here for the Cavs. They had the third best defense on the season. That defense travels, although their road record was pretty porous compared to their home record. I mean, you saw what Orlando did to Milwaukee on the final day of the regular season. That team was brutal to go against at home. And when they are rolling in transition, when their defense is getting stops, they're going to be a really difficult matchup and a team that's going to give plenty of fits to Darius Garland, just based off of a size standpoint. Any general first, I mean, just we have to keep it moving. So just any thoughts on this matchup from you?
Yeah, and I'll add something. That Orlando team is a team that plays like it has a chip on its shoulder.
Yeah.
And they are going to go into that series saying, oh, you rested your players in the last day of the season because you wanted to play us. You might have been thinking you were just avoiding Philly, but what we interpreted was you want to play us. And this is a team that already plays with a chip on its shoulder. It's in the tier one of the most physical teams in the NBA. You say no, you say people aren't going to watch that? I'm hyped for that series. I think that series could be really fun. I love watching the Magic. I think Jamal Mosley has done an incredible job with that group. One of the most difficult things for a head coach in this league is to get young teams to defend. And that's in part for sure, because it is younger players just don't have the experience. And defense is very intellectual in a lot of ways. You have to understand the speed of the game. You have to know opponents' tendencies. All those sorts of things.
You think you're an intellectual?
No, I don't defend. And so this team defending at that level, and not just because you have to learn all those things, also because it's hard to get a group of guys to sacrifice and care about the gritty, non-glorified stuff when they haven't gotten paid yet. That's really, really hard. I'm so impressed with the buy-in on that team, with Cole Anthony just being like, yeah, everybody thought that I was just this guy who's going to go out and get his. Nah, I think I'm just going to become one of the best rebounding guards in the league, and I'm going to torpedo myself into screens at every single chance that I get. And I'm just going to be a nightmare to play against. People are just going to hate playing against me. I love watching that team play. And I'm, look, they can't really shoot, and their offense falls off a cliff, but Cleveland got into this horrific stretch over the last 30 games of the season when Garland has not looked like himself. And the one thing that I think is really interesting is they're just never closing with Mobley and Allen anymore. And that team was constructed on the basis of you're going to have the two guards who are going to handle the offense, and you're going to have the two bigs who are going to anchor the defense. And in your most important moments, Cleveland is saying with their actions, since March 24th, when Mobley came back from injury, Mobley and Allen have played 25 fourth quarter minutes together in total. They just don't play them together anymore. And Orlando is a team that can match, if not exceed, their size. Jalen Suggs is a hound. I'm very curious. Jonathan Isaac has an argument as the best. I'm not going to say has an argument. Jonathan Isaac is the best per minute defender in the NBA. Really interested to see how they match his minutes, what they do with him. Mosley's creative. They're probably going to do some really interesting stuff with Isaac against Cleveland's, you know, offense. Mitchell hasn't looked like himself.
They could just throw him on Donovan Mitchell for a couple possessions. Why not?
They'll do it. They'll throw him on a guard.
Yeah.
They'll put him on a non-shooter and let him roam. I mean, the dude is just does everything defensively. If he could play more than 15 minutes a game, he would be first team all defense all the freaking time. He's magnificent to watch defend. It's otherworldly. It's like him and Wembanyama and Gobert, like they're all kind of in that class right now. I like what Orlando has going for them. And I think they got karma on their side. Not a religious person, not a spiritual person, not a superstitious person. Orlando's got karma on their side.
Orlando's got karma on their side. Evan Mobley, I am curious to see what he looks like in this environment. You saw it up close and personal last year. He had this great defensive player of the year caliber type season on that side of the floor. But in the postseason, it was very, very apparent that all the preseason talk last year, before the 2022-23 season, not this year, Evan Mobley's in the gym and he's got a three-point shot now. And he has still left a lot to be desired, I think, even in Cleveland's building, of him being the two-way player that he was expected to be when he was a top potential pick for the number one pick in that 2021 draft. So that's something I'm looking at in this series as well. And I'm looking at a real rivalry between Milwaukee and Indiana in the 3-6 matchup that I think was a real side effect that the league was hoping would come out of the in-season tournament, where you were adding more high pressure playoff environment type games in your conference. So now the fact we've got Milwaukee and Indiana having already played 5 games this season. We had the game ball gate even before all that stuff, or after that stuff, the trash talking, Giannis having to be held back as he's trying to run down the tunnel to find which 29 and a half inches of orange leather was the right one. You got some Pat Beverly in here now. The Bucks are not quietly 17-19 under Doc since a 30-13 start under Adrian Griffin. We have no idea what the real status of Giannis's calf injury is. Can the Bucks play defense without Giannis when Malik Beasley was the one who was shadowing Tyrese Haliburton in full court in Vegas when I was there for that in-season tournament semifinal game? Will the Pacers just run them to death? It's going to be a really interesting matchup, just also being that Milwaukee's got a ton at stake too. This is the team that fired their championship coach after losing in the first round when things should have been going the exact opposite direction. And now they have, on paper so far, just one of possibly the worst matchups they could have drawn to get this monkey off their back and try to show Giannis that this is still a place he can compete for championships in. After all the talk he did in this preseason slash fall about maybe I won't sign an extension, and sure he did, but in this NBA world, even though the ink is dried on a contract, there are plenty of teams who are waiting and watching to see what happens in this series if Milwaukee does fall short.
It will be. You know, it's a little difficult to glean much from those regular season matchups. I know Indiana so clearly had Milwaukee's number. No question. But the last time they played, Adrian Griffin was the head coach of the Bucks. Pascal Siakam was on the Toronto Raptors. Buddy Hield was on the Indiana Pacers. Giannis Antetokounmpo was healthy. Pat Beverly was on the 76ers. Ben Mathurin was healthy. Like, there was a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot different. A lot different there. TJ McConnell wasn't balling out the way that he is right now.
TJ McConnell's always really balling out. Always balling out.
Constant state of balling out. TJ McConnell wakes up in the mornings and is like, you know what? I am Dan Devine.
No, TJ McConnell wakes up in the morning and says, you know what? I need to kill any motherfucker in front of me so I don't lose my spot in the NBA. That is TJ McConnell right there.
That is true. And the Pacers, by no coincidence, are defending a lot better than they did in the early season, in part because they have Pascal Siakam now, who's been very good for them. They're not good defensively at all, but there's an argument they're better than Milwaukee. I am really curious to see what happens in this series. And by the way, that was before Tyrese Haliburton got hurt, and his production has obviously not been the same since his injury. So I'm really curious to see how it goes. The thing that I'm really watching is Haliburton against Milwaukee's perimeter defenders, because Milwaukee just doesn't really have guys to guard the perimeter. Guards, wings will consistently slice them up. And really their best line of defense is that they have Brook Lopez, who's still a fabulous rim protector, being able to play drop a lot of the time, hang around the paint, and just walling off the rim. And they have Giannis in weak side help when Giannis plays. And the guys who can really carve them up are just guys who are really good jump shooters. Haliburton's jump shot has not been the same since he came back from the injury. He was automatic at the beginning of the year. And part of the reason, by the way, why the Pacers just destroyed Milwaukee is because they play so damn fast when they're going well. And Milwaukee's transition defense under Adrian Griffin was a nightmare. It was really a problem. And that was like the number one thing Doc Rivers wanted to edit when he got there. And it's not been good, but it's been better. It's not in the dregs of the league in terms of transition defense. Now they're much better at getting back on defense. I'm really curious to see that dynamic. I'm really curious to see how Haliburton goes about trying to slice up Milwaukee's weaker perimeter defense. If he can do it with just jump shots for a series, if he can do it so much that now he's commanding two on the ball, and now you've got one of the best distributors in the league just finding shooters. This could be a fun series too. I actually think people are sleeping a little on the Eastern Conference playoffs. I think we got some decent matchups.
They are. We will, of course, see who Boston draws in the 8 seed after tomorrow's matchup between Chicago and Miami. But that will do it for our bounce around the Eastern Conference with our lovely guest, Fred Katz. Thanks for filling in today, man. This was fun.
I'm thrilled to be here. I'm always happy to podcast with you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make the show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. That'd be great. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap.